saw a show on Friday night called Sound Space. Mm-hmm. And it's actually put on by a New York-based dance troupe.
Yeah.
It's the choreographer is by Michelle Dorrance. Mm-hmm. And I had this fascinating Zoom with her, in which we kind of talked about the genesis of the whole thing, mm-hmm. because the thing is kind of a tap dance thing, yeah. but it's much broader. Because, you know, about how tap dancing traditionally is fairly narrow repertoire, mm-hmm. but it has an amazingly unique place in American social history because mm-hmm. it actually came out of the slave tradition and. So that's really fascinating. And I think what she's trying to do here is to kind of push the boundary with tap dancing. Mm-hmm. Because, for example, like not in this show, but in one of her other shows, and I saw the video of this, she actually adapted Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker for tap dancing. So there are all sorts of possibilities. And I remember talking to her, and we discussed the rhythmic possibilities mm-hmm. of tap dancing, because tapping is incredibly rhythmic exercise.
Yep.
And I think what you've seen in recent decades in pop culture and just in culture in general is the way in terms of like musical rhythm has become such a huge part of our lives. Mm-hmm. Look at, for example, rap, right? Rap mm-hmm. is basically started out as kind of just rhythm. And it's this fascinating discussion about how you have these old forms or ancient forms and you can translate them into all sorts of different possibilities depending on modern life. And the show itself is great. The show itself kind of started out it was a little bit hard to understand, but, you know, gradually it just became very obvious what she was trying to do. 70 minutes. There are 9 dancers yeah. and 1 choreographer. The choreographer isn't actually here. And they had 2 performances, Friday and Saturday. And Saturday was actually, the time I was looking, it was actually sold out. Mm-hmm. So this was clearly a very, very popular thing. And it's just kind of a amazingly new way to look at the possibility of dance and music. So I thought it was just really, really cool. I generally think people should go on and explore what they can do with their traditional music and artistic forms.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Oh, I should add a little bit of biographical detail about the choreographer. Yep. The show is called Sound Space, and the dance troupe is organized by Michelle Dorn. I remember speaking to Michelle, and I was kind of just asking her what led her to tap dancing.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out her mom is a ballet dancer. She started out in her childhood in Carolina doing ballet. And there are parts of ballet she really enjoyed, kind of the faster, more rhythmic parts of it. And there are parts, kind of the more elegant parts, as she called it, she didn't actually enjoy as much. So she thought this transition to tap dancing was in many ways a predestined one. And she went off to university at NYU. I guess it just kind of happened. And she also was a soccer player in her youth. Because her dad's a soccer coach, and it's just kind of all these rhythm and stuff like that. It just became like a perfect thing for her. So this is really cool.
Interesting. So tell us a bit about sort of the progression of the show. I was actually at a completely unrelated event on Sunday morning, and some people had attended one of those performances Friday or Saturday.
Yeah.
And they were mentioning how it starts out up, and then as the show progresses, backing music is brought in?
Yeah, so I think this is kind of the way. I think it relates to something we discussed in earlier, which is the show, the first half is just mostly tap. And then music and so forth is brought in. Mm-hmm. I think when we were talking about this on this earlier, when she originally came up with the idea for the show, it was like in a church. I think it was in St. Mark's in New York, like 100-year-old, several hundred-year-old church. And one thing she realized was you can create this sense of tap coming closer because they're tapping on the rafters of the church. And it was just kind of a weird but really, really cool kind of audiovisual experience, you know, as you can feel the tap coming closer. I think, in this case, it's kind of more of a tap thing. I personally do find that, you know, as this goes down, kind of more of a musical integration is easier to understand, a little bit more accessible. I do think I do get the feeling with, you know, in chatting to her that this is an ongoing project and, you know, it's a living project and it will change over time. It's kind of harder to understand for a broader audience. But yeah, and that was kind of what it was for the first 30 minutes. But I think ultimately the show, kind of as it, kind of the music is brought on, it's these things some shift over time. But I do expect the show itself will shift over time as well.
Great. So this was on Friday and Saturday. That, I guess that was just...
Yeah, it was at the Vancouver Playhouse.
Yeah.
Around, you know, 8 p.m. and 70 minutes. You know, all these stand shows are like 70 minutes.
Yeah. Amazing. It's really interesting because, you know, I think I would say, you know, I'm a bit older. So I remember used to see tap stuff on the TV and fair bit. It was still sort of something that, you know, in the 70s and the 80s, past its heyday, and really kind of sort of... I wouldn't say disappeared for a while.
Yeah.
But it does making a bit of a comeback, a revival perhaps, you know, as new artists like...
Michelle Dorns.
Like Michelle Dorns, you know, rediscover and then reinterpret it in the 20th century.
Yeah, I think one thing I'm thinking about right now is something like Hamilton the musical, right? Right, like it's you have all these forms which have been, you know, Broadway musicals, established repertoire. Everyone goes to New York to see Cats, whatever, you know, whatever. And then suddenly someone comes out with a brand new kind of fusion of it, and, you know, with all these things and integrating like American founding history. You know, perhaps not my favorite history, but, you know, like, it's kind of like, but this is really, really cool kind of stylization. I do think this is something that's an ongoing process with TAP that's just begun. It is, as I think, as your friends and as my experience has shown, sometimes even in the current sort of guise, it still could be a little bit difficult to understand, at least in the first half. But I think that I think the thematic possibilities of TAP are there, right? Because it's such a strong rhythmic thing. Like it's when it was done traditionally, it was kind of done its own. It's just a pure rhythm. But I think it's as you kind of just feel from rap and from Hamilton, from all these things, it's about the integration. And I think that's going to be an ongoing sort of evolution and metamorphosis. And so I think I look forward to that. And I look forward to that beyond just because, you know, hopefully I'll be in some shows like EDM or whatever going forward.
Yeah.
And same thing, right? EDM, originally a very, very restricted kind of format. And now it permeates everything, right? Like, it's in Taylor Swift. So, you know,
it's in advertising.
Absolutely. It's made it. So,
yeah. Summarize what the show was again for me.
Yeah,
for
so audience. I was really lucky to go view a show on Friday night called Sound Space, organized by Michelle Dorns and her dance troupe. And it happened at Vancouver Playhouse on Friday and Saturday evenings. And it's kind of a new interpretation of the possibilities of tap dancing. And in the second half, there was music, and it's kind of all these cool things. So that was a great experience, and I look forward to their future evolution.
Awesome. Thanks for bringing us that, Stephen. All right. American indie band Helmet is playing at the Commodore Ballroom tonight. They had their heyday in the 90s, one of the most popular heavy going. This is from their 1997 album, Betty. This is Helmet.
We got the garden.
Helmet and Wilma's Rainbow from the album Betty. They are performing at the Commodore Ballroom tonight, and it's still available. So, Pete, you're going to talk about Truthers.
Well, what it is that Alex Jones got this reputation. He was the man who predicted 9/11. Yeah. There was another person who actually did. His name was Bill Cooper. Now, interestingly enough, I went to InfoWars. I usually don't, the little website, you know. And they actually had Bill Cooper saying, oh, here's Bill Cooper, and he had some interesting things to say. But there was a time there was a big, giant riff, Alex Jones.
So before you get into that, let's set up who is Bill Cooper. Because, of course, we all know Alex Jones is the by now infamous sort of conspiracy theorist. He's built kind of empire around his radio show and podcast, spinning all sorts of different conspiracy theories. But who's this other fellow?
Starting in 1992, had a shortwave radio show. Okay. And actually, 1990, so did Alex Jones. Mm. So this is before the internet, even though it exists in its kind of skeleton outline, the internet. Yeah. And so people shortwave.
And one of the things about shortwave radio, for those who don't know, is you could, from your transmitter, broadcast over an enormous range. You were our signal here at CTF. You know, we broadcast from top of a mountain, and we reach sort of pretty much sort of central greater Vancouver.
Lougheed Mall, maybe, where I live. Yeah.
But you can reach hundreds or even thousands of miles.
Yeah, that's right.
So as a vehicle for this fellow, it a lot of people.
Yeah, more than, not quite CBS Evening News, but anyway. Now, he, of all things it says here, Cooper sent his show via audio cassette to a direct telephone link to WWCR in Nashville, where it was broadcast by the station's 100,000-watt shortwave transmitter.
Wow. So what was the name of his show?
Oh, the hour of the time. That was his hour of the time. And what happened, this was the riff. Both Alex Jones and Bill Cooper had shortwave radio shows. And Alex Jones, he got very alarmist about it. And actually, Bill Cooper was very critical of it.
Right.
And that was the riff, because by the end, going into year 2000, Alex Jones was sort of upset that Bill Cooper had been very critical of Alex Jones. Because in 1994, and this is dating ourselves, but I remember it. The idea of Y2K was all the computers were going to supposedly be in from zero.
Yeah, because the years were, like in a date, the years were only recorded with the last two digits. So
right.
98, 99. Then systems, computers that read those dates wouldn't know whether it was 2000 or 1900.
Right.
Because, you know, the default was that it was... His number meant 1997, meant 1998. So 00 must mean 1900, not 2000.
Well,
so there's a lot of talk about how this was going to create great deals of chaos.
Yes, ATM and so on. Yeah. But it got patched up. But supposedly, this was the first Alex Jones hysteria over only shortwave radio, though. and Bill Cooper, who was... anyway, he was into a lot of things, but we'll maybe get into that. But I'm going to say where 9/11 comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I found out it was Bill Cooper, not Alex Jones, who had done it, and I thought to myself, how did Bill Cooper this? Intelligence? Was he? But no, this is what happened. In June of 2001, CNN... they're talking about Bin Laden.
Yeah.
And actually, there was an attempt in the 1990s. Bin Laden had done, or the terrorist had did a fake in sometime in the 1990s. So CNN just brought it forth. Now, what is sort of surreal about this is that presented the conspiracy theory about 9/11 prior to it happening. He said, oh, they're talking about Bin Laden and he's going to be blamed for it. And of course, it's kind of odd, kind of feel, well, Bin Laden is the person, and his not him directly, Christy, but the network is Al-Qaeda did it, but just said, oh, wait, you're going to see something, and they're going to blame him. Well, anyway. Then, in July 2001, Alex Jones just parroted. Mm-hmm. He just completely, and they had a riff, which they don't have now, many years after he died. Now he's got Bill Cooper on there from the past. But, no, there was a major riff. So Alex Jones just said it like, oh, he just thought it up. But what's interesting is, in a sense, it was CNN who sort of predicted 9/11. But we didn't know. Like, the thing was, people always knew there was going to be eventually some sort of attack. Mm-hmm. And until that attack happens, you can't have all the security because it just seems totally unwarranted. It's only once it happens you can have it to prevent a future one. Mm-hmm. Now, what happened to Bill Cooper was that he had taxation problems. And, well, it wasn't so amusing to him.
Sure.
He's Magnus a bit chuckling over his. No, it was quite serious because here he is. He is the person who predicts 9/11. In November 2000 was the FBI. He got a bit paranoid about what happened, and there was overtaxation, and he was shot dead because he took out his gun and made a few shots, and they shot him. And he was a bit younger than, I'm 61. He died at 58. He had a wife and child, yeah. A few kids. So that just left the ground clear for Alex Jones as the predictor of 9/11, you know, mm-hmm. because Bill Cooper was dead and call of Alex Jones anymore. So
right.
And he actually, about a year later, he would say something like, oh, Bill Cooper, I never thought much of him. But now they do. Now he's. Yeah. Now, one thing about how my reasoning over the years, actually just directly about that, I think, forgetting the technical aspects of it, from a political aspect, it's very convoluted how the George W. Bush administration would have orchestrated it. It just kind of is a real mind-bender. How would they have been the political conspiracy to have it happen? So I just don't buy into any theory about it. But the some of the technical aspects about what happened is that actually trade a center building, which no longer exists. I guess they rebuilt it or something.
Well, there's something. Yeah, they built something different.
But the one from 1973, this was a very good building structurally. And one of the things is that, I mean, it could well be I don't know if it would have hit two planes and they were sturdy or something. But actually, no, there was something wrong with the building. And it just was lent itself. Well, not so much a lend-off. It wasn't like it. No one would known at the time such an attack would have happened. But
and of course, you know, the architects aren't. You know, they're building it so it stands up against gravity and against wind forces. Not, you know, each tower being hit by a giant airplane.
Right. If you are going to have a planned attack against a building, the World Trade Center Twin Towers were the one to do it because of construction.
Right.
In 1973, the real concept was that it would be the tallest building in the world. Mm-hmm. And for a few years, all of the office space is actually rented out.
Right.
Which was actually the fate of the Empire State Building when it was first came out in 1930.
Yeah.
For 1929, wherever it was done. And it was for both structures, they had people, security personnel, flickering lights on and off to make it seem that there was rented space.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting also about the World Trade Center is that PBS, after 9/11, it had happened. It wasn't like something they had just broadcast later and they had done it. So they do it in the context that 9/11 had happened. They do a documentary on the Twin Towers, and don't have positive to say about the building, but they talk about how when we're talking about post 9/11,
yeah.
You would have thought PBS would have said to have two straight lines in the middle of nowhere or something.
Yeah.
No, but they were talking about the complaints mm-hmm. when it was first done.
Yeah.
And all, there was some high wire act at one point in the 1970s. Over.
I've seen the documentary. They actually made a movie, a film about it too, like a dramatic commentary about it as well, where the guy who sort of stealthily, like he didn't get approval or figured out how to get to the roof and then one side to the other and string a cable across and then do a high wire walk across between the two towers. You can probably more info.
Yes, incidentally, I think he was doing it to be a critique of the building.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it went from aesthetically, the sentiment, PBS couldn't muster up some sentimentality about anything about it. It's like, it is sort of unsentimental. It's like it was just so mm-hmm. stark and whatever. Yeah. But anyway, Stephen, do you want to weigh in on trutherism?
I mean, I was going to say that being able to predict 9/11 doesn't seem that impressive to me because the person involved in that, Mr. Bin Laden, had already attacked U.S. forces in act of terrorism years before. I think it was like Mogadishu or somewhere. I don't know. So I think, you know, it's like being able to predict the financial crisis. Everyone claims to be able to predict the great financial crisis, a determined event. Oh, you know, like... Why is that a thing? Like that's my perspective. I'm not invested in terms of like who predicted what to predict easy things. So, you know, yeah, I don't find that kind of a fascinating kind of a
Yeah, I mean the idea that Bin Laden and his group were out there something was
it's common knowledge. It was in the report.
It was something it was something that was being talked about. You know, at the end, you know, the scale of what they did, you know,
surprised
shocked
everyone.
And it surprised everyone, right? Because, you know, they're thinking like, you know, a truck bomb or stuff like that had happened before, which, you know, can be, but to bring down, you know, these two symbols of the American, of the United States and
American
the world.
American capitalism.
Yeah, and the world financial system was, was pretty shocking and surprising.
Well, I mean,
what
like.
Happened.
Like, look, my expertise is not Mr. Bin Laden or 9/11. That's my area of focus, in a sense. But, like, I think a very comparable event, obviously not, well, actually, I don't know, that's different, is the Great Financial Crisis. And I know a little bit about that. And it's kind of like, you know, it's the signs were there. Like, when you look, even in 2005, 2006, or potentially earlier, that you had an entire decade of venture investment in technology in the 90s, and then that bubble went popped in 2000, March, I think 2000, whatever, and responded by encouraging people to buy houses and engage in consumption.
Yeah.
And it's not so much that 7 years of this itself produced a gigant. It's that it's all this stuff that was unresolved by the end of the 90s suddenly popped up again in 2007, 2008, and you had an apocalyptic economic crisis that really was just in...
Yeah, and the idea that there was a housing bubble, a quite large housing bubble, had been talked about for years, right? Before 2008.
Yeah, I mean, like, ultimately, there's an absolute iron rule of housing, which is that... You know, like I think there's a ratio between housing prices, and then the ratio is like between 120 or 200 or something like that. And you know, once it goes out that ratio, you know, you know there's going to be some. And in 2007, you know, people were buying things on cheap credit, and it was unavoidable what was going to happen. So I think it was not a great surprise. I think a lot of people who prize themselves on, you know, The Big Short, predicting the financial crisis. Well, where were you the other times?
So, if I could weigh in a bit about the housing, kind of like the Midwest, like areas in the West Coast, New York City, it didn't really experience that drop in prices. What it was the George W. Bush administration was pushing for this idea for a lot of people who had not owned homes to be able to own a home. And that brought them into sort of bad situation. I guess there's a term, you're underwater, because what you're paying in the mortgage is going to be more than it's worth.
They were doing, you know, as part of that, they were doing, you know, these sort of predatory...
negative amortization.
Well, yeah, that, but also, you know, signing people up for mortgages that had a